When people commit crimes of a sexual nature, there are often requirements that extend beyond their time in custody. We're talking about people convicted of crimes of a sexual nature. Sexual offender registration is in place all over the country, often with wide variations in laws from state to state. Recent reporting in the Oregonian indicates that police agencies in Oregon are way behind in entering names into an electronic database of registered sex offenders. And perhaps the bigger story is the fact that based on the numbers available, it appears that Oregon has a greater concentration of sex offenders than just about any other state. This is our chance to talk about what the deal is with the laws that affect sex offenders and how they are managed through the system once they're out of actual police custody. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this. Our guests are John Watson, Deputy Director of Jackson County Community Justice. John, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we also have Bill Wilkenlow from the same department. He's a parole and probation officer there. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And on the phone, Tom Madison, who's with the Oregon Action Committee. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with each of you in turn. So, John Watson, just explain basically what goes on at Jackson County Community Justice and what you have to do with people who've been convicted of sex crimes.
Well, by the time they get to our office, they've had their due process, they've had their day in court, and we're looking at about 265 people that we currently supervise. We have three and a half probation officers. We're going to be adding a fourth person to supervise those people. We look at risk, so we use some validated risk tools to determine their risk to be harmed to the community or to commit new crimes, and we supervise them at that level. We do home visits. We check on their employment. They're all engaged in treatment. So we try to look at the people that we have here, keep tabs on them. The people that are not on supervision, the registered offenders in Oregon, sometimes we don't even know that they exist until they commit a new crime.
Really? So why do you not know? You mean because they show up in the county and you don't know that they've...
Right. They could be from another state. A lot of times they'll come up from California. They won't adhere to the registration requirements in the other state. And we have no way of knowing if they're here. Once they get here and they need to register, then the state police would make sure they register. If they're here illegally, then they could be charged with a new crime, failing to register, and then they would be on our supervision, and we would know where they're living and what they're doing.
Given the tight jail space in just about every place in the region, it seems like what is the penalty for failing to register?
It depends. It depends on the court process. It could be some jail time. We do have a transition center here that we can look at. For people that are on a 5 to 10 day jail, we can do home detention. We can do community service. So we have a variety, besides just actual lockdown in the jail, ways to sanction, but it depends on the court process.
You mentioned 3.5 probation officers. So is that because they're allocated to something other than sex offender stuff, or just because they're actually a half-time person?
No. Actually, we had 4 full-time parole and probation officers dealing just with sex offender crimes. But because of some of the budget cuts, we had to move some caseloads around. We had some movement. We wanted to get a fourth person back on that caseload. We have a person that's doing a half of a sex offender caseload and half of another caseload right now. But our goal is to have 4 full-time parole and probation officers that just do sex offender supervision.
And how many people involved in the other parts of parole and probation, not sex offender?
We have 20 full-time parole and probation officers, and we will be hiring we got a grant to supervise domestic violence misdemeanor offenders. And so we will be hiring another PO to deal with that caseload. So we will have 21 full-time officers very shortly.
I'm certain there are some people who are going to think, oh, wait a minute, 4 doesn't sound like a very great number when you consider the community concern about sex offenders and things they have done in the past and could do in the future. Is the number low? Is it about right? Is it based on caseloads?
Well, it's based on caseloads. Like I said, we have 265 sex offenders right now on supervision. With 3, that's averaging about 85 cases. And now those are high, medium, and low cases. Some of the low cases are finished with treatment. They're doing everything that they need to be doing. They're working. They're not having any issues. With the fourth person, we're hoping to get those numbers down to about 55, 60. both high, medium, and lows.
John, you also might want to share the recidivism rate.
In Jackson County, our once we get a sex offender in our program, and Bill can talk about what we do with the sex offenders, because we require them to take polygraphs, we require them to be intensively in treatment, and we monitor their home, we monitor pretty much every aspect of their life. Our recidivism rate here in Jackson County is about 1%. Now, this is it's a very small – they measure recidivism after somebody has completed probation. They watch them for 3 years afterward, and they look at whether they commit any new crimes, whether or not they have any more officer contact, law enforcement contact, and they're convicted of a new crime. So it's a small – we don't have that many sex offenders. I mean, 265. There are a lot of registered sex offenders, but not – the actual people that are on probation compared to the rest of the population is a pretty small amount. So that we have about 20 or so people that get off probation. So it's about 1%. Statewide, it's about 6%, but that's all crimes. So if a sex offender gets off supervision and they get a theft, that would be counted toward a recidivism rate. It's about 3% that actually have another sex crime. Oregon is very... They do some really good work. Most of the counties are very, very forward-thinking as far as sex offender treatment. Jackson County many, many years ago was a testing model for how we do sex offender treatment. It was
a resource.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. We have much more to talk about with John Watson and Bill Wilkenlow from Jackson County Community Justice. We will bring in Tom Madison from Oregon Action Committee to talk about his perspective on why the laws should be changed about sex offender management and registration. And we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Numbers again, 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and you. In a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our topic today, sex offenders and how they are managed by law in the state of Oregon, including registration laws. We have a couple of guests with us from Jackson County Community Justice. John Watson is the deputy director there. Bill Wilkenlow is a parole and probation officer. And we have with us as well Tom Madison from the Oregon Action Committee, who would like to see the laws changed. We'll find out how in just a few moments. Join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to something you said a few moments ago, John Watson, though, about recidivism and the issue that 3% of the people who are sex offenders commit another sex crime, which is a pretty low figure.
But that's statewide.
All right. But you said also, I thought, that if they're found committing some other crime, that is considered recidivism, even if it's not another sex crime.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah, they track the criminal behavior is obviously something that we're interested in. The sex crimes are very distinctive, and obviously that's concerning if somebody's. But a lot of the time, people that you have to look at a lot of different factors. Have they completed treatment? Are they working? What are they doing? Sometimes you have people that abscond probation or are just not compliant, and we're constantly trying to redirect them, jail sanctions, community sanctions, getting them back in treatment, trying to break down some of those thinking errors, some of that denial, some of that resistance, if you will.
So, Bill Wilkenlow, I want to hear from you, since you're out in the field managing the folks through parole and probation. Then, what's the job like? We talked about high, medium, and low cases. I mean, what's the mix of cases you have, and just on a daily basis, what kind of work are you going to do to monitor the people you're in charge of monitoring?
Well, I'm glad you asked about the level of risk, and we do risk assessments that are state mandated, and all the counties use them to determine whether they are a low, medium, or a high risk. And when it all's fleshed out at the end of the day, in fact, you had mentioned something about the jail being overcrowded, and it costs the county about $84 a day. These are 2011 figures, to put a person either in the county jail or in prison. Now, to supervise a person on parole or probation, if they're a high-risk offender, costs about $16 a day. If they're a medium risk, $11.70 a day. And if they're a low risk, 78 cents a day. So you can see there's quite a savings to have parole and probation officers monitoring people rather than building more jails and more prisons. It's just not going to work.
But this is where people begin to get scared, though. And I know there was a preliminary discussion that really didn't get that far in the last regular session of the Oregon legislature about, it did get some places on, but wipe out what I just said. There were adjustments made to the ways that certain sentences were handled, I believe, in this legislative session, so that the prison population would stay relatively flat in Oregon. More people would potentially end up on parole and probation. It's certainly cost-effective, but I'm sure what the community wants to know is, are we as safe?
Well, the bottom line is, everyone who goes to prison isn't going to stay there. They're coming out, and they're going to come. They're going to be your neighbor. Oregon doesn't have laws like other surrounding states that limit where these people can live. There is a limit if they're on supervision where they can live. They can't live next to schools, parks, playgrounds, or places where minors congregate. But when they're off probation, when they're off parole, they can live anywhere, and you have no control over that. So having them on supervision for a longer period of time rather than just having them come out of prison and be done, to me, it makes more sense. While they're on supervision, we can help them practice to live like, you know, law-abiding citizens, and then teach them what it's going to be like, how they're going to have to manage their life under the rules of living as a sex offender, having to register, having to be cautious about who they're in contact with, so as not to bring, law enforcement into their life or Department of Human Services, child welfare interfering in their life. That won't happen if they follow all the rules and they stay away from minors or whatever their victim range is, because some of our offenders don't have minor victims, they have adult victims.
Let's hear from Tom Madison. Tom, sorry to keep you waiting this long. You're with Oregon Action Committee, and tell us your story and what the Oregon Action Committee itself is all about.
Well, I'd be glad to, and I appreciate you having me on your program today. It's not an everyday occurrence that a registrant such as myself comes onto a radio program and tries to tell the world that there's a lot of light that has not been shed on the sex offender registry issue nationwide, let alone certainly in a community like yours. But the Oregon Action Committee is really aimed at the again putting light on a subject that's been a very dark topic for a long time. Real facts that actually pertain to the underpinnings of the registry have never really been brought out much before. What I'm getting at is the reoffense rates that, was mentioned here in the program earlier. Those are pretty good figures, but it really doesn't get at the issue of why, when a person serves their time in prison, they have finished their obligations to the state, so to speak, they have to go onto a registry. And our organization has two goals, and really they're one and the same goal in a way, to repeal completely the registry laws in Oregon, and if not that, then of course to reform these laws drastically so the vast majority of registrants come off that registry immediately so they can join their families in peace and harmony in a family, be the law-abiding citizens that they really are. And I guess that's about it in a nutshell.
All right, so you're a registrant yourself, so you're a registered sex offender, you're saying?
Yes, I'm a registrant on the sex offender registry.
What and how long do you have to stay on the registry?
Well, in Oregon, it's a lifetime. Now, in my case, in most cases, you can apply for relief or to be delisted off the registry. That has to be something that's 10 years after the time that you finished your obligations. For me, that'll be in 2015. Mm. But as I understand it, very few people come off the registry because I think the politics of the time, you've heard these other gentlemen talk about it, there's a tremendous amount of fear and angst in our community about the scary sex offenders that the media mostly portrays as out of control, troglodytes of a sort that come out in the night and to take your children away, kind of like the boogeyman system, syndrome. And really, if you look at the facts, as I will hope to get into here, you realize that really, the whole issue, I'm trying to fly up to the highest level here and look down upon this. We have in this state begun a persecution of a group of people that have really, there's no reason to have any kind of persecution. But when we persecute people for ongoing, a sense of that they have committed or are likely to commit crimes against citizens in the state, in the community, then that's very unfortunate. One of the things that is the biggest part of our message as to why we should repeal these laws is that the vast number of sex crimes in the community are not the registrants themselves, but are family members. There are members, and acquaintances of the family that account for about, I think some of the recent statistics say 94% of these sex crimes come from family members and acquaintances, and a tiny sliver come from stranger sex offenders, but even those stranger sex offenders are people that are first-time sex offenders. So at the end of the day, a scintilla of percentage of those on the registry, the ones that the Oregonian article in their Sex Offender Haven article talked about, were a small, small portion of people that commit new crimes as registrants. And so we're trying to shed that light on this topic and say that the thing is 180 degrees out of phase with regards to reality.
But Tom Madison, if a small, small percentage, by your terminology, commit these crimes as registrants, does that not in fact encourage people to continue registration because they think that they're not committing these crimes because they are registered?
Well, and that's been brought before, but going back to when the Oregon adopted these laws in 1989 and changed it to lifetime registry in 1991, the trend was already towards low reoffense rates anyway. And in a free democratic society where we really value equality under the law for all citizens, why on earth would we continue to bring additional legal requirements to people that have paid their debt to society when the vast number of these crimes are committed by not those persons anyway? Why would we continue to do that?
We're talking about sex offender laws and sex offender registration in the state of Oregon as currently carried out. Tom Madison is with the Oregon Action Committee and a registered offender, and he'd like to see the laws changed. John Watson is deputy director at Jackson County Community Justice, where Bill Wilkenlow is a parole and probation officer. You can join this discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. John Watson or Bill Wilkenlow, does anybody who's committed any kind of a sex crime end up being a registered offender?
There's certain types of pretty much everybody would need to register. And my take on that, I mean, I was a sex offender PO for 8 years before I went into administration. And I got asked a lot of times by people, by family, by court, by judges even, can you guarantee that this person, they've been through treatment, that they're not going to reoffend or they're not going to be a danger to the community? And I can't answer that. The best indication of future behavior is past behavior. That's what we learn and we see every day. At some point, something happened to make somebody commit a crime or to offend somebody. And our hope is that they never do that again, and we give them the treatment and the tools that if – but it comes down to them. So I think the registration is an information source. And people are – I get asked, how do I keep my kids safe from sex offenders? Be informed. Know who your kids are talking to. Know who your kids are visiting. Know if there are people in your family. He's absolutely right, Tom, that a lot of the sex crimes are – relatives, people that the children know or the adults know, they're not strangers. But that doesn't make it any better. It's still somebody was offended.
So I was going to say currently not everybody has to register. You have rape, sodomy, sex abuse in the third degree as long as the victim is at least 14 and the offender is not more than 5 years older than the victim and there was no force involved. The victim basically complied and there was no they weren't intoxicated or they didn't resist in any way. Those people do not have to register. They get instant relief. So they're convicted. They don't have to register. And if anyone had been convicted, and this just recently changed, if anyone had been convicted prior to that of those similar crimes and had to register at that point, they can apply for the instant relief through the courts. And just so everyone, I don't know, laws are there to do two things. They're to detect when things go wrong, and they're to deter from things going wrong. And so sex offender registration, I look at as kind of being, you know, it's a deterrence for other people. And, you know, if there's a low recidivism rate on the people that we know who are registered, then I also think that it deters others who may be thinking about these kinds of things from not doing it as well, because they don't want to be registered. They don't want to have to live like that.
That low recidivism rate that was mentioned, I think it was 3%, you said, John Watson, is that much lower than for other categories of crimes? I mean, if you've committed armed robbery, is the recidivism rate higher than 3%, for example?
Well, probably compare it to something like drug crimes. Now, you're looking at that, and those are, I don't know what the statistics are, but drug crimes in our community and surrounding communities are higher, property crimes are higher than sex offender crimes, much higher.
Yeah, when you're dealing with addiction issues, you know, a new PCS, they're looked at differently. I think when somebody goes through treatment and gets the tools and they're compliant and they have the polygraphs, they really don't have a whole lot of wiggle room. They need to get with the program. And if sex offender, we have some excellent treatment providers here in Jackson County that do very difficult work, but it's intensive, it's confrontive, and the other people in the group, it's a group process. They know what is happening. They know when people are in denial, when they're minimizing crimes, and they confront them. It's so when somebody goes through all that, they have a good chance of getting on with their life, but they still need to work their program. If they go into situations that are risky, they could have a problem.
Tom Madison, how long a program does somebody have to work?
What do you mean by that?
Well, the program, as John Watson just said, you have to go through your treatment options, all the other stuff that is required of you as you get into post custody supervision.
Well, but there's all kinds of sex offenders. I mean, there are 22-year-olds that have sex relations with their girlfriends, let's say at 15 years old. There's a difference there. Okay, they broke the law. I don't know if those people have to go through any kind of counseling, but I mean, really, I mean, they broke the law, but I wouldn't consider them mentally ill of any sort. So there are those cases. There are in-family incest type cases, but I guess maybe in the minds of the average Oregonian, it's going to be in their imagination, maybe in terms of, including what they may have read or listened to in media, it's going to be, a 45-year-old who molested a 10-year-old, that kind of thing, and maybe that person has, through some circumstance, ended up molesting that person. But by and large, a lot of people on the registry are not fixated in terms of their sexual predilections. It's usually circumstantial. A small percentage have a fixated need to be around children and want to harm children, but they're the far, far minority in this whole population of sex offenders. And so you have to say, well, of all of the entire range of sex offenders, which of these people really would benefit by treatment, and which of the others would be a complete waste of time? And I think the evidence is in that. I mean, by and large, most of these people, yes, they broke the law. Yes, they did their time. And yes, they need to be free of any further obligations to the state, is our position. But in terms of treatment, no. Most of these people should not require treatment, because they really aren't people that are likely to reoffend anyway. The statistics show that. And we need to make sure that those people get off a registry and get on with their lives. That's what we're all about.
Bill Wickenlow, did you want to say something here?
I do. to make a determination as to whether someone needs treatment or not just based on the crime they are currently convicted of is really an inaccurate way to determine that. And part of treatment that we do and many counties do, you have a person in treatment, you have them do a sexual history disclosure, they do a polygraph, and they reveal all of their victimizing behavior, their entire sexual life, which is validated through polygraph. And there really is no other way to determine. You can't take their word for it. You can't base it on one conviction, because sex offenses, sex crimes are historically underreported. It's horribly embarrassing for the victims.
Let us take a call here. We have Derek in Ohio. We'll take the calls in the order we got them. Derek in Ohio, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about sex offender laws and registration with John Watson, Bill Wickenlow, and Tom Madison. Derek, you there? Derek, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I thought I would call and heckle Tom for a moment. I actually been working with him, and you know, for quite some time on the on this national network of individuals who are looking to they're looking to reform these laws, and there's something I want Tom to discuss, because this is a big elephant in the room that for some reason hasn't been brought up yet. Is the impact of these laws on registered persons themselves. The law enforcement agents claim it's a deterrent, but individuals like myself who have lived on this registry for quite some time obviously see things a lot differently. We've experienced things. Tom has been working with me on a documentary on a particular a particular incident that happened in Washington State last year. Two individuals who were murdered were targeted because they were on the sex offender registry. And there's another thing too. I know I'm kind of rambling here a little bit, but there's another thing too I would like for him to bring out.
We need to take a break here. They're hardwired into our system here, so we'll take a break. We'll come back and talk, get the thoughts finished up from Derek in Ohio, and talk more with Tom Madison, Bill Wickenlow, and John Watson about sex offender laws and sex offender registration in Oregon, back here on the Jefferson Exchange with these gentlemen and your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Topic today, sex offender laws, sex offender registration, as it applies particularly to the state of Oregon. We're talking to John Watson and Bill Wilkenlow from the Jackson County Community Justice Office, where they supervise through parole and probation sex offenders and people on the sex offender registry. Tom Madison is a registered sex offender and a member of the Oregon Action Committee, would like to see the laws changed. And we have online Derek in Ohio. We'll get him to complete his thought, but you can join as well. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email jx@jeffnet.org. Derek, what were you going to finish up with?
Well, there's two things. Hopefully Tom can do this in a real hurry. First of all, I would love for him to address the so-called unintended consequences of the registry, such as vigilante violence and whatnot. And also, he knows I live in Ohio, and Ohio is an Adam Walsh Act state, which is the federal law that the Oregonian kept alluding to but would not, specify in their report. And I was hoping Tom would, possibly, tell the viewers about the experiences with the Adam Walsh Act in a number of states. I know it's a two-part thing, but I think these are both important points that people need to hear.
All right. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it, Derek. Tom?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. Before I get to the family members who suffer under these laws, as well as the registrants in that particular family who shares that common address on the sex offender registry, I wanted to go back to something you said before, but one of the other two gentlemen online with you today, the concept of deterrence. And it is important that we have deterrence. We don't want sex offending to happen in our society, but I think we have to be careful how we use deterrence. We have ordinary laws. I mean, everyday laws in the ORS, the Oregon Revised Statutes, that they're pretty tough on crimes generally, and especially sex crimes in this state. They go away. Sex offenders will go away for a long amount of time when they break the law. But to then additionally to say that that person who served his time could go on a registry, and then to say that the registry itself is a kind of deterrence to keep others from offending is really, I think, hugely offensive, because it's using these people as political pawns, as legal pawns, to help with the problem of deterrence generally. Laws as they are, not considering registry laws, but the punishment laws, the sentencing laws, that is where your deterrence comes in. It is a dangerous, very dangerous step to go into a philosophy of risk assessment on any member of society, to use risk as a basis for to help solve a problem, because when you get into the area of risk assessment, you are walking down that slippery slope of having to surveil people such as registered sex offenders to watch their moves, and that just smacks of anti-democratic principles in the way that it operates. We live in a society today where NSA spies on Americans. We live in a society where we have illegal wars overseas committed by war criminals in the White House and past administrations. If we're so interested in protecting children, why do we bomb and kill women and children overseas? I mean, that's,
all right, all right. That's I want to narrow the focus back down.
Today, I know.
There, yeah. Let's bring it back to the sex offender issue here. Tell me in particular, what are you prevented from doing by being a registered sex offender?
Well, I am prevented from doing almost nothing in the broad sense, but I am under the gun of having to make sure that if I travel across the country like I have, I've been in Miami, I've been in Columbus, at various rallies and organizing other registrants like myself across the country, when I travel, I have got to be careful about the local laws, the county laws, the state laws where I'm traveling, because there are laws there that say if a registered sex offender is traveling through that territory, if you don't register and pay close attention to the laws in that state, then I could be arrested simply for being too long in one place if I am traveling.
All right, I want to hear.
That is something that's very much on my mind when I do travel to do my activism across the country.
All right, Bill Wilkinlow, you looked like you had something you wanted to say.
I did. You know, I don't know the laws in all the states, but I'll just talk about one very close to us in the state of Nevada. If you're a felon, regardless of what the felony is, and you stay in that state more than, I believe, 48 hours, you have to register with the state of Nevada that you're a visiting felon. It could be a property crime, a drug crime, any crime.
So not just a sex crime.
Sex crime. And Oregon is not a public registry unless you are considered predatory. If you're less than predatory, your picture is not on the website, your address is not on the website, there is nothing. People could Google you to see if you're on the website, and you wouldn't even show up.
All right, but the sex offender inquiry system, which I had a chance to run through last night at the state police website, is that just the predatory offender?
Just predatory.
Really? All right. Let us take another call here. Here's Denise in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting. We're talking about sex offender laws in Oregon.
Hi. Tom, you are, to me, so out of touch. I just can't believe I'm taking notes because I cannot believe what you're saying. Starting with the fact that you're not the boogeyman and that molest happens within the family. Well, you know what, Tom? You belong to a family, and you might be a boogeyman, especially when you justify this and minimize it. The crime that you've done, I have so many girlfriends that are screwed up for life because of this, and they're trying to get so much help. I'm blown away by what you're saying. I think you said it's a waste of time for some of these treatment programs. Okay, then take the key away and lock you up if it's a waste of time. Because we don't, you know, I think these sex offenders get smarter. So they doesn't look like they're reoffending, but they're smarter in how they do things. They get their needs met. Now, I'm not saying an 18-year-old that got with a 14-year-old, I agree. I'm not saying that. But you said some of the crimes were circumstantial. Does that mean a little 5-year-old went by in her nightie? I am just appalled by what you're saying, and I think you're so off target. Don't minimize this. And what are you doing in Columbia? Hello? Right. I don't get that one either.
Yeah.
Let's get a response,
Columbus,
Denise. Thanks
Ohio.
For the call.
If I said Columbia, I meant to say Columbus, Ohio. I'm an activist in trying to work with other sex offenders, but I do want to address that caller. So she raised something very important here, and that is when a person finishes their obligations to the state, that should be it. They finish their sentence, whether it's probation or parole, they finish all of that. That's the end of it. That should be the end of it. These people need to get on with their lives. And don't forget, and this is what Derek brought up out of Ohio, and this is very important, when you put people on a registry, you're also putting that family on a registry as well. Family members, wives, you know, spouses in general, their children, sex offenders on the registry in Oregon have children in some cases. Sometimes they're young people who have parents. But nonetheless, that common home address is on the registry. Why are we punishing those family members as well? And also, the employers, should a registrant have the fortune of having a job and they're on that registry, that employer's address goes on the registry as well. Imagine being a customer of a restaurant, let's say, who finds out that a registrant is back there washing dishes. You might not want to put your and visit that restaurant and give it business. That business might suffer. All of this adds to the the on and on persecution of people on the sex offender registry, which is a very sad statement about our time today.
So, Bill, let me get this from Bill Wilkins.
We seem to be concerned with the emotions and the harm that has been done in the past, but we will not forgive the registrants, and I think that's the core of the problem here. We need to forgive people who have broken the law in the past so they can fit in as good law-abiding citizens today.
Bill Wilkinlow, what's the truth about the information? Obviously, the address is there as part of the registry.
So again, reflecting back to what I said before the break, only predatory sex offenders are, that information is available to the public. Everybody under that is not. So,
and what defines then the line between predatory and non-predatory sex offenders?
So there's tools that have been used by the state for years. The Static 99 is the primary one, and the score based on that tool, if you're a 6 or above, determines whether or not you are a predatory sex offender. And really, to be honest, there are predatory sex offenders on the public registry. I have a list of them here that are on our county website, and many of these guys have jobs, have families. No one's harassed them. No one showed up at their house. They go pretty much invisible because people don't want to interact with them anyway. So if you, as a new homeowner, moved into your neighborhood, called Oregon State Police or looked up on the public inquiry and found someone close to you, do you like the house or not? Because you can't control who moves in or around you. And so you make decisions based on what you're going to make your decisions on, and you know, you live your life the best you can.
I would add too that in order to be considered predatory by the parole board or designated, there you have that Static 99, which is a validated risk tool. So it's not just Bill coming into the office and looking at it and all of his bias and, you know, whatever.
So it's
a
not
human
one
being.
Guy and a set of feelings.
No,
it's a whole matrix to go through.
It explained to me one time when you're flying in an airplane, you can't always know what's going on outside just by your senses. You need to have gauges and things that aren't subject to human emotion, things like that. And that's kind of what we look at with these risk tools. They're validated, and they give us an idea. In addition to that, the predatory meet with a therapist, and they're more likely – they're still exhibiting behavior or aggressive behavior or things in their personality that make them more likely than not to exhibit behavior that could be considered not good. I mean, that they could be harming – propensity to harm another person. So we're not talking about the sex offenders, the statutory, the 19, the 15. These are people that have done things that are not good things, and they've harmed people. And as I said before, past behavior is a good indication of future behavior. That's why we want, as a neighbor, as a family, as somebody, I want to know that this person is there. And that just gives information, as Bill said, to people that this is the group of sex offenders that are the highest risk.
But why would we care that they're there? Why shouldn't they just be invisible like every other citizen in an anonymous way? Why do we care? Most of these crimes are committed by, as I mentioned before, repeating myself, family members and acquaintances and first-time strangers. Why do we care? Why can these people who are the predatory types simply live with their go on with their lives? You know, if they break the law, then they're going to be held accountable. Why can't we as a free democratic society focus on things that are really matter instead of wasting?
All right, so I'm glad you brought this. I was going to ask you anyway if you wanted to repeal the law, repeal it how? And the answer is just do away with it completely. You want no sex offender registration whatsoever?
Well, as an eventual goal, absolutely. But I know that the political realities are going to be, it's going to be a very slow process. It's going to be a reform issue first. For example, the first thing we ought to do is to get rid of 90% or so of the sex offenders on the registry. Let's just say that we get the legislature to agree that if a person on the registry who has not committed a sex crime in the last 3 years, just get their names off of it. Reduce the number down so these probation officers around the state have a load that is much lighter. The state police and local law enforcement can focus on the remaining group of people, about one-tenth of what it was before. And then over time, we say that the registry is not a public registry. It's only in the hands of law enforcement, and that ultimately beyond that, only at some point the only time that you are on a public register, that is, you're on a registry, pardon me, is when you're under supervision of a probation officer, parole officer, and I think that's the direction that we have to take this, so that eventually this ugly third world notion of doing risk assessments and public registries and civil forfeiture laws and all of the ugly third world type of law enforcement that we've gotten into, we do away with it and get back to the principles of law and order, equality under the law for everybody.
All right, John Watson, you wanted to get in.
I just wanted to make a comment. Why do we care? Because when a sex offender reoffends, they create another victim. And as Denise said, there are people – when somebody has been a victim of a sexual crime, they often deal with that for the rest of their lives. And unlike some drug crimes where people are using drugs, a sex crime, you create another victim or you re-victimize a victim. And that's why we care, because I am not interested in creating any more victims. And so knowledge is you know, a lot of times people do commit the same crimes, and we want to know what's going on.
Bill Wilkin, though, you had a point.
My point, to reiterate, these are underreported crimes, and these are crimes that are done in secret. They're not on the street corner dealing drugs. They're in your home. It could be a family member. It could be a close friend of the family. It could be a stranger, but they're all done in secret, and they threaten victims, don't tell, or I will harm you or your family. On almost most of the sex offender histories we look at, they use threats to get the victims not to tell, and guilt and shame.
Now, the risk assessments you were talking about, though, this is a case-by-case basis, so each person is really going to have the risks that are perceived dealt with individually. So that will determine a couple of different things about how they handle parole and probation, correct?
Correct.
So it's not, for example, like Measure 11 sentencing, where you did this, bang, you're going to get this. In parole and probation, there is some variation from case to case.
There is variation. We're not going to put the same guy, give him the same amount of treatment or type of treatment. If he is a rape one guy compared to the guy who had sex with his girlfriend who was 1 year under the legal limit. It's just different.
All right. Well, obviously a lot more to talk about, and we're not going to have time to do it today. But I want to thank Bill Wilkinlow, parole and probation officer from Jackson County Community Justice. John Watson is the deputy director. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
Tom Madison from Oregon Action Committee, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. And that'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You can find show topics and recordings as well on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the revamping of the Oregon higher education system with Southern Oregon University President Mary Cullinan. We'll talk about the Sustainable Valley Initiative going on in the Rogue Valley. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about Tragedy at Tunnel 13, a new effort to recapture what happened back at that tunnel up in the Siskiyou Mountains back in the 1920s, what's been billed as America's last train robbery. It actually was a quadruple murder with no robbery at all. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.